Welcome to episode 220 of Redboard Rewind. My name is Spencer Luganbiel, and today my special guest is In the Money Media's very own Nick Tamaro. Me and Nick go over three races from this past Saturday at Keeneland Racetrack. Those races were 6, 8, and 10, and some angles that we talk about are how using a past stretch-out performance almost helped Spencer cash a 30-1 long shot in his across-the-board bet, and also why the Sycamore may not have been the strongest race for a favorite in the Elkhorn. This is Redboard Rewind. It's the same old story in this cycle. We go back and forth. We go back and forth. It ain't good for me what we do this for. We go back and forth. Won't do this no more. And now I'd like to welcome in my special guest for this week's edition of Redboard Rewind, friend of the pod, big friend of In the Money. It's Nick Tamaro. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing great, my friend. Glad to join you a little early. I usually join you post-derby, but we're 2 weeks before.
I had to get someone in for Keeneland, and with you being the new morning line maker, it's something that I want to talk about because I've had David Aragona on, other people. And I kind of want to just get your ideas on... With morning line making, you've done it at Sam Houston, obviously smaller track. What's the hardest part about Keeneland? Obviously, a ton of shippers. Everyone knows that. Is there anything other than that kind of aspect? Is it a bigger condition book? Is it what exactly makes it more difficult, do you think?
Yeah, so I guess this is my fourth meet at Keeneland. I started in the fall of 22, which also included the Breeders' Cup. And it's a very competitive track, obviously. The racing is very strong. Generally, just as it is handicapping, setting a line in a race where it's very competitive on paper is obviously more difficult. You know, if we were dealing with 6 and 7 horse fields with one standout, you run a much lower risk of getting caught with a bad line because horses generally aren't going to be bet down. I also steadfastly stick to what I think is the cardinal rule of morning line making, which is that my lines never exceed 129 points, I should say. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, you could sort of take the easy way out and put out a lot of 135 to 140 point lines and you would look like they're more accurate. But what people actually miss is that they're more inaccurate and you're going to have more times where you put out a line that from the beginning was inaccurate in terms of how you laid it out. So I would say, you know, the abundance of very competitive racing, the amount of turf racing that's really difficult. What's been particularly tough, more so in the spring than the fall, is dealing with all the turfway form.
Yeah.
Because you have a real horde of runners, especially in the claiming races, coming from turfway. And, you know, what I made a note of last year, and I have a notebook where I write things down to remember. And some people are probably going to listen and think, yeah, you don't do a very good job of it. But, I tried to remind myself, you know, look for horses with recent synthetic form with back dirt form. And, you know, it's not always that easy because a lot of these horses have not run much more so than they have on the synthetic. So it's very difficult, no doubt about it. You know, having done the line at Sam Houston now for about 5 or 6 years, which now includes quarter horses as well, that gives you at least a little bit of practice. It is easier in the spring, having made lines pretty much all winter into the spring, mm-hmm. to just be in that frame of mind. The other thing that's difficult about it is that, and one of the things I admire David Aragona about is that he can separate himself very well between line making and horse playing. And that's very difficult because I think I've definitely gotten myself into trouble making lines on horses that I wouldn't be all that interested in betting or that I, you know, that I might be, and they end up being inaccurate because the public isn't going to see it the way I do. And so I think getting a feel for that, getting a read on that and executing it properly is difficult.
It's almost like the contrarian view of looking at a horse and realizing that 90% of the public will be into that part of the horse. And everyone who tries to, you know, quote unquote, make money at this game isn't onto that type of aspect. So I can totally get that side from you. You talk about the synthetic form and stuff like that. And obviously Gulfstream went back to synthetic. I did not get a lot of synthetic time when Keeneland was synthetic. So for me, obviously it's my worst surface and I just feel better now that we're kind of getting a mix and match of all three. It makes it a little bit easier. But I remember when I first started out, sometimes it would be Turfway be the only thing running at night, and that's what I would focus on, and just getting blasted every single night. And I'm like, I got to figure this form out. And it's not only a quote-unquote softer track, but it's really difficult with full fields, and it's just a lot of, you know, I think evenly matched fields until you get certain trainers that come in. I mean, no one really is hitting a ton of percentage over there. But for you, was with the synthetic shippers, what is something that you think, you said, well, obviously the back dirt form, is it from specific tracks or is it just dirt to synthetic and then back to the dirt?
A little bit of that, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I used to enjoy doing, especially, you know, early in a meet like Arlington, was betting against horses that were short prices because they had dirt form. And, you know, you get a little bit of that. We've gotten a little bit of horses overbet on synthetic form racing on dirt now that may not otherwise really be dirt horses. And so you have to really keep an eye on that. You don't want to let yourself get caught maybe putting a little bit too much into recent synthetic form. One of the things I've learned about synthetic racing as it has become a little bit more popular is that, you know, no two synthetic surfaces are equal. It seems like what happens at one sort of exists only at that one and not really anywhere else. And obviously there's very little correlation between dirt and synthetic. They're just two distinctly different surfaces. You don't get much overlap. I think the other thing that I've kind of learned, and this is probably more of a handicapping exercise than a line making one, is that it used to be, and you know, back when, you know, when you're discussing when Keeneland had a synthetic surface, which was 10 years ago now. In fact, our last meet on the synthetic was exactly 10 years ago. You could really take the approach of turf equals synthetic for the most part. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's the case. You know, I think to an extent when we were dealing primarily with Polytrack, I think Polytrack probably had more turf crossover, but the Tapeta surfaces at places like Gulfstream and Turfway, while they don't always correlate form-wise, I really don't think the turf equals synthetic is a good approach anymore. And I think it's one that I've kind of learned the hard way. You've got to be careful with.
I love that you brought that up, because that was actually going to be part of my next question. You always hear, you know, turf synthetic form can kind of mix and match. And for me, I've always been one until they run on the surface. And listen, I'm not the best pedigree handicapper of all time, but unless if I see like, okay, it's turf to synthetic, both parents won and like half the siblings won, to me, I'm just not going to play those type of horses on those pedigree moves, where if the horse is already like that, everyone in the world is going to see that for the most part on the pedigree side. So they're just going to play the horse as what that one will be. Pedigree wise, surface wise, as a handicapping tool for anyone who's just listening and with me and Nick, if you don't have substantial, you know, ideas, and obviously 3-year-olds are going to have very limited sample size, you want to see at least, you know, two good races. We're going to talk about a horse for me later on that was kind of making a same move with a different trainer, but just the farther you look back in the PPs, the more you can learn. And so many people I think are just so, oh, you need an 80 to win this race. Well, he didn't run an 80 last time, so toss him out. But he might have 3 or 4 races back run a couple 80s in a row. And I think back form is just something that younger handicappers just don't assimilate to as much as the old time handicappers. Do you kind of agree with me there, Nick?
Yeah, I think the public puts an incredible amount of emphasis on the last 1 to 3 running lines. And one of the things that I think creates some of the disparities between what the public expects and what the CAWs end up betting is the CAWs do a remarkable job of identifying back form and assimilating some of that data into their approach in the actual race and really exposing where those horses are in an advantageous position. So, you know, I definitely learned this in terms of the line making exercise that, you know, the CAWs will very nicely forgive a horse that might have some, you know, lackluster recent form, but some really strong back form. There was a horse in particular on Saturday at Keeneland in the 5th race, the one horse from Mike Maker's name was Sakil, and he had a lot of really good back form. It was probably, you know, 5, 4, 5, 6 starts down the line, but he was running dirt races from a speed figure perspective that would make him a really tough customer. And it was just buried with a little bit of bad recent form. And he got bet from start to finish. There was just a couple of scratches in there that probably drove his price down a little bit. But I mean, I made him 10 to 1. He went off 5 to 2. So that's a bad line, even with a couple of scratches. And he was a horse that got bet, like I said, you know, beginning, middle, and end. And I think that had a lot to do with it, that he did have that good back dirt form that people were willing to look at and say, hey, you know, if he runs back to this race, he's going to be tough. So, yeah, I think those things are important to remember and important to recognize, because if you can sniff them out in a positive way and you're on a little bit of an island, you really give yourself a huge edge.
Before we get to the race, I do want to let you know, obviously, it's a thankless job being a morning line maker. I think you do a great job. And I think sometimes you let the heckers get to you, but I saw the one instance where the guy was saying some crap about you, and you go, well, what would you have made the horse? And the guy just could not come back with an answer. And I just feel like I'm one of the few people of the younger people of the generation who do like to make a line, you know, whether it's the 100-point lines from the old handicapping books, et cetera. But just, I don't think people realize, you know, when you go to a race and they go, who do you like in this race? Oh, I like the two. And that's all they'll say. Not, I like the two up to a certain amount of odds, or, you know, down to a certain amount of odds. It's just, I like the two. And I think if people start realizing, if you look at it from a line-making perspective and just look at it in a percentage-wise, you'll start to find a lot more value. Yes, you're going to get beaten by favorites. Yes, the public's still one of the best handicappers in the world. But doing that type of exercise will help you become a better player.
Oh, 100%. You're absolutely right. Indisputably so. And yeah, I mean, if you're going to play this game seriously and you're not going through an exercise of trying to assess the prices that horses are and what you would like to get back in terms of what you constitute as value, then good luck. I don't envision you having a lot of success long term. So yeah, I mean, that's part of every race is basically assigning a value proposition to the horses that you want to either bet or bet against. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the morning line is basically to be used as kind of a study guide. It's really not, you know, you think about studying for an exam in school, you had a study guide, but then you also had your notes, and your notes are what you're supposed to use to really get prepared, whereas the study guide is a little bit more of an overview. And I think people forget at times that, you know, the morning line is one person's approximation of what the public is going to bet. That line is often made 5+ days in advance. That's the case with Keeneland. So, you know, these Saturday cards, I make that line prior Sunday, turn it in that morning. And at that point, I have basically missed 4 days of racing leading up to that day. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know which trainers are now winning left and right. You know, last year at the end of the fall meet in 2023, Brad Cox went on this enormous tear the final week of the meet. And I had made a first time starter of his 8-1, and the horse ended up galloping at 7-5. And so, of course, I mean, it looked like just an egregiously terrible line. And obviously, I should have made the horse a shorter price. But if I had the benefit of knowing, you know, what Brad was going to be doing those last few days, then I would have. So, you know, I'm definitely not trying to manipulate anything. I'm definitely not trying I'm obviously not deliberately doing anything wrong. It's just, it's a tough place to make a line for. And I'm trying to do what I can to get paint as accurate a picture as possible. And that's easier said than done at times. So it's, it's a tough job. But hey, look, I will never dispute anybody who says to me, it doesn't matter, you get paid to do it, you should get it right. I absolutely should. No disputing that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I'm big on accountability in my life in general. So I'm always going to be accountable for that. You know, some of the stuff, I have one guy, we've now exchanged messages back and forth. I said to him, you know, there's no point in being a dick. Like, if you have an opinion about a line, then tag me and ask me what my thought process was for that particular race. And so he and I subsequently ended up having a conversation about a race that's going to be run this week. And it was good. You know, he thanked me afterwards. And so, and, you know, I appreciated him asking, and maybe I'll end up being wrong and he'll be right, or vice versa. The bottom line is that we're all going to have opportunities where we're right or wrong. And it doesn't really change our overall opinion. It just makes us horse players, and it makes us human.
Let's jump in to the first of our three races for this podcast. We're going to start with race number 6 from Keeneland. It's a gigantic purse for an N2X, 1 mile on the turf, $120,000. I mean, they're practically listed stakes now for the allowances at Keeneland. Nick, what'd you like in this one?
Yeah, these races are like all events now. You're absolutely right. So, you know, my handicapping approach to this race, and I think the line making obviously mirrored it, was that I thought Sacred Wish was going to be way too much for these horses on paper. Now, I didn't love that she was coming back from a layoff. But George Weaver historically has been a trainer who's good with fresh horses. And I thought she really took off when they put her on turf last year. I mean, for that matter, she was a pretty damn good dirt horse as well. So I felt like she'd probably be able to work her way over from the outside post to at least a decent position. And I was alive in some pick threes here to the 10, 11, and 12. You know, was never all that concerned about them all being on the outside. But I think my approach to this race maybe changed a little bit when we saw a pretty pronounced front end bias on the turf course. I thought there was, at least. I thought it was a major advantage to be forwardly placed on the turf at Keeneland pretty much throughout last week, especially Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And so I didn't get too concerned, Spencer, because I felt like Sacred Wish would probably never really be that far off of it. But yeah, that was kind of how I viewed it going in.
I thought for me, and I had circled Sacred Wish originally, and the thing that scared me the most was the horse didn't really take much money. I mean, obviously now we're down to the penny lines in Kentucky, which still blows my mind looking at it in the results charts half the time. But to stay at 2-1 with this horse, I said, okay, where else can I look in this race to maybe try and find a little bit of value? And I thought the 4-1 Silk Stocking, if you look back at the allowance and the Megahertz, the 86 and 87 buyer, I thought fit really well in this kind of spot. And again, 6.5 to a mile, went 6.5 last time. Now we're going a mile again. It is under new trainer Ricardo Ramirez. The horse had a couple works. I like to take horses in the spot because A, it's further, like we said, farther down the form cycle. And when they can stretch out and they run well doing it, that's something for me that, and I know you said there's a front end bias. I was hoping this one would be a little bit more forwardly placed. Off of that last race, obviously nobody wants to be nine lengths off or in ninth going down the hill at Santa Anita. But I thought One Silk Stocking to hit the board at a price like 15-1, I thought was a little bit interesting in this one.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, she had some form that you could at least point to. And I also agree that I thought Sacred Wish never really took the money that I thought she would. The horse who took a lot more money in here than I expected was the 8 Glittering Lights. And, you know, I never considered her for a second. I have definitely been a little fooled at times by the amount of money the public throws towards Brendan Walsh. He had a first time U.S. horse the week before in a maiden race that I think I made 7-2, and the horse just got bet relentlessly and won at 8-5, which I didn't take any flack on Twitter for that one, but that's a miss. And, and so the same kind of thing happened on I guess that's all the people who comment, a miss on their part as well. But I didn't like Glittering Lights because I thought she was going to be coming from way too far back. You know, these horses very rarely come to America and have any speed. So I thought she'd probably spot them way too much ground. But I agree. In looking through the race initially, and then especially with Freitas the Red and American Retro scratched, I thought Sacred Wish would be 6-5. And she never really did take that big surge of money. She went off 2-1, but really didn't even get hit that hard late from a betting perspective.
Sacred Wish, Nick's top pick with a little bit of other outside horses. For me, I'm trying to hit the board with a long shot and One Silk Stocking. Let's see who gets it done right now.
There goes Moonray. Moonray out for the lead. Miss Reed is there to the inside. Samay comes away running in third. And then Woohoo Jackie Blue is fourth and Sacred Wish fifth alongside of her as they move into the first turn. Moonray the leader. Moonray clears the traffic, is over to the rail to save some ground, leads it by two lengths around the first turn. Samay goes second a length. Miss Reed is third by just a neck. Woohoo Jackie Blue third on the outside. Then a gap of two more lengths. One Silk Stocking is fifth back toward the inside. Sacred Wish sixth on her outside, headed up the backstretch. Then Pleasant Passage is seventh. Olivia Maralda back toward the inside in eighth. Storm Bay outward from the rail up the backstretch is in ninth position. Glittering Lights is in 10th. And then Quality Star last of the 11. The opening quarter went in 22.99 seconds and Moonray is the leader. And Moonray has the lead out to three lengths now as they head for the far turn. The first half mile 46.27 seconds. Samay is second a length and a half to Woohoo Jackie Blue just outside of Miss Reed. Followed by One Silk Stocking, Sacred Wish up on the outside, who now moves to the center of the course, goes to fifth, still six lengths off the lead. Pleasant Passage, seven to make up. Quality Star, nine to make up. Olivia Maralda, 10 from the front. They turn for home. It is Moonray, Miss Reed to the inside. Samay is there. Sacred Wish out in the center of the course. And then a late run from One Silk Stocking down toward the inside, but still in fifth position. Quality Star, center of the course. Sacred Wish coming after Miss Reed, but Miss Reed has the jump on her. Miss Reed in front by two. Sacred Wish. And then Olivia Maralda coming late. Miss Reed in front. Miss Reed wins it by a length on the line.
1. And it is Miss Red getting the job done. 83, the winning buyer. 15, 48, the winning mutual. I've lost some sick photos before. This one at 31-1 hurt a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, if you had the exacta, this was a really tough beat because I will say it wasn't a tough trip that got you. I mean, she did have a very good trip. Tyler Connor actually gave her a very good ride, saving a lot of ground. She actually ran fourth. If you needed her in the try, it was a dirty beat. The thing that I was a little surprised by was that she was farther off the pace than I expected. I thought she'd be way more engaged early, which you alluded to in talking about it pre-race. So that was a little frustrating. You know, I think the thing about the winner, this is a classic case of watching trips on turf, right? The winner never left the fence, and the favorite and the horse that I thought would win, and even to a lesser extent to 12, never really saved much ground. The favorite never saved ground at all and ended up making a 3-4 wide move all the way around the turn, which is just an absolute death sentence at Keeneland. So it ended up going to a horse that got a brilliant ride. And, you know, Luis Saez is a guy that I've not always extolled in terms of being a turf rider. He gave her a great ride. It was just impeccable in terms of how he orchestrated that whole thing, saving ground. And when she got a place on the inside and upper stretch, she really came through with a lot of willingness. So it was a good ride. And anybody who liked Miss Reed got the 6-1.
I think a lot of times when it comes to turf, for me at least, you know, I'm not the big race replay guy, but trips do matter, and it's good. And obviously we have the comments in the DRF. We know they're not that good. There's people who you can go out and you can spend your money on. They'll give you the right trip notes, et cetera. They'll give you more than you can usually do in your spare time. And, you know, class is the other thing for me. It's really strange for me. It's class and the race replays. And then for dirt racing, it's the speed figures and the pace a lot more for me in this, but like you had said, perfect ride when four horses kind of, you know, finish within the length of each other and it comes down to trips. That's how you get the job done in that one. But let's move on to the next race. Race number 8 from Keeneland. We're going to go a mile and a half on the turf. It's the grade 2 Elkhorn. I've always struggled with these long distance races. I tend to kind of just look for horses that are, you know, going to show either okay form or maybe want to go the distance a little bit. I ended up on the 2 outside horses. I thought Missed the Cut, Irad, John Sadler was a little bit interesting in here. Look at the last 4, the San Gabriel, mile and an eighth, mile and a quarter, and they go a mile and a half. They're slowly stretching this one out. Had all the right type of figures in here to win. This one loves to win 7-15. Usually these types, you know, especially on turf, they can kind of, their nose finds the wire more than they get lucky. But my top pick in here was Silver Knot on the outside, with Flavian Pratt and Charlie Appleby. It's almost the fact of how many times do you get beat by the 3rd or 4th Chad, you know, for the fact that Charlie had 2 in here and the other one was going to be, you know, such a dominant type, you know, at 3-2 in Bold Act. I thought, why couldn't this one get it done? Slowly improving, you know, 86, 89 to a 90. Had yet to run a quote unquote bad race. I want to be called the Belmont Derby a bad race, but I just thought in this race, at the price that I thought Bold Act would go off at, I wanted to find 2 horses here that could possibly get the job done.
Yeah, you know, the interesting element to Silver Knot was that this horse really looked as if it was a bit of a surprising scenario that Appleby would want to run this horse a mile and a half. Mm-hmm. And he really, it seemed like, went out of his way in 2023 to keep him shorter, in part because he had horses. He obviously has a ton of horses. And so he didn't really need him to go much longer after kind of the Pennine Ridge. It looked like he wanted to keep him a little bit shorter. But the fact that he was willing to run him long in here, I think, said a little bit about what he thinks this horse's ultimate ceiling might be distance-wise. And I initially, you know, in looking at the race when I was first making the morning line and then in handicapping a little bit, I thought, is he maybe going to use this horse as a rabbit? And then I realized, he's got a little bit too much quality to him to just make him a rabbit. So it did look like he'd be forwardly placed. He was pretty forward. He was pretty handy throughout his 3-year-old campaign. And he was looking, of course, to avenge a very narrow defeat in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf from 2022. You know, the Bold Act situation, and I did sort of foresee this as much as I could a week in advance in making this horse a pretty short price on the morning line, was that the public is just relentlessly betting the Charlie Appleby horses right now. They're pounding them. And I made this horse 3-2, and he ended up going off 1-2. So he was a huge favorite, and he had won – the Dowager last fall, or the Sycamore, excuse me. But that is not, that field felt like it probably didn't have horses in it that were in the kind of form that Missed the Cut was, or had the back class that Silver Knot does. So it did feel like a bit of a tougher objective. And I think taking 1-2 on him felt like kind of a fool's errand. So in my multi-race bets, I used the two Godolphin horses, and I didn't make an intra-race bet, but felt like certainly if I was going to, I wish I had a little bit more confidence ahead of time in Silver Knot.
Did you have one Godolphin over the other, or they kind of split 50-50?
Kind of 50-50. I didn't press Bold Act at all, which obviously means that I was supposed to be gravitating towards Silver Knot from a betting perspective.
Bold Knot. Silver Knot, Bold Act for Nick. For myself, I'm going Silver Knot, Missed the Cut. Let's see if we can kind of beat this strongly bet Charlie Appleby horse. Let's see who gets the W right now.
In the Visit Lex Elkhorn Stakes, there goes Wintrue. Wintrue from between horses up for the early lead. King Curlin there to the inside. Highland Chief in between horses. Silver Knot moves up from the far outside. It is Wintrue to the front. Wintrue gets over next to the rail, leads it 3/4 of a length. Silver Knot will go second by a length. King Curlin third, 3/4 of a length. And then Highland Chief, who is fourth up on the outside, Missed the Cut, fifth outward from the rail. Then Bold Act, sixth back toward the inside. Lucky Curlin is seventh. Dyna Drive toward the outside is in eighth. The Gray Wizard is last of the nine. The opening quarter went in 24.04 seconds. It is Wintrue leading it. Silver Knot is second, just off his flank toward the outside, with just over one circuit to go in the Visit Lex Elkhorn. King Curlin back toward the inside is third, joined there by Highland Chief, who stacks up to the outside in fourth. Bold Act is fifth, placed against the rail just inside of Missed the Cut. 49.82 seconds the time for the first half mile. Dyna Drive, Lucky Curlin, and the Gray Wizard to complete the field. It is Wintrue who shows the way, though, and Wintrue leads Silver Knot by a length. And then King Curlin back toward the inside is third, a half length from Highland Chief, who's in fourth. Another length and a half to Dyna Drive, who sweeps up to the far outside. Missed the Cut is there between horses within 4 lengths of the lead. Bold Act is still against the rail, still six from the front. And now here comes Highland Chief alongside of Silver Knot moving to the outside of Wintrue. So Silver Knot between horses leads at midpoint of the backstretch by a head. Wintrue is still there and fighting back to the inside. Highland Chief third up on the far outside. Missed the Cut fourth. Bold Act is in fifth, still down toward the rail, 3 lengths off the lead. And then King Curlin, Dyna Drive, Lucky Curlin, the Gray Wizard, they're onto the far turn now. It is Wintrue who has the lead again. Wintrue leads it by a neck. Silver Knot draws alongside once again. And then Highland Chief to the far outside in third. Missed the Cut is fourth, just over 2 lengths off the lead. Bold Act is still fifth against the rail, just over 3 from the front. They turn for home, quarter mile to go. Silver Knot to catch, and Silver Knot leads it by 3 lengths to Missed the Cut. Highland Chief, Bold Act, and then Lucky Curlin. Silver Knot into the final furlong, a 3-length lead. Missed the Cut second. Bold Act is third. Silver Knot in front in deep stretch. Silver Knot, Flavian Pratt aboard. Silver Knot wins the Visit Lex Elkhorn.
And it is Silver Knot that gets the job done. 98, the winning buyer. Looking at a nice price of $13.52 for the winning mutual. And I just want to bring up something you said about just class before we kind of get your ideas on the race recap, and saying that how winning the Sycamore, but going back through that field and realizing that, you know, yes, this horse did win a race, but didn't have two horses like you had said with Missed the Cut and Silver Knot. And I think that's why a lot of people nowadays, like for me in Formulator, I'll still go back through and I'll try to figure out, you know, key races, stuff like that, you know. One of the old James Quinn ideas was if you haven't won two stakes races in that class level, you're not a, you know, you're not a glorified stake winner in that type of field. And I think that's so important when you look at these type of races. Sometimes it does absolutely burn me, but I definitely thought this was a stronger spot than the Sycamore, and runs third. The other two get it done, but you know, it must be nice from a line maker when 1-2-3 kind of, you know, it runs somewhere in that idea.
Yeah, exactly. No, and you're right. I mean, what we were alluding to was that last year Sycamore had the second choice. Bold Act went off 2.88 to 1 that day, and the second choice was kind of an over-the-hill Red Knight. So limited liability was the third choice, and he had been brought back earlier at this meet in an allowance race. So, I mean, that was a much weaker group of horses from top to bottom, because there wasn't a horse like Missed the Cut in terms of the form he was in, and there wasn't a horse like Silver Knot in terms of the back class that he possessed. So I think it was totally fair to have that kind of critical viewpoint of Bold Act, knowing that he probably had a bit of a tougher objective on his hands. The other thing that I mentioned in talking about the race flow and the track profile was that it felt as if there was a big advantage at Keeneland over the few days of the weekend to be forwardly placed. Mm-hmm. And you know, it felt like Silver Knot was going to be significantly more forward, whereas Bold Act likes to do his best running late, and that would give him a big edge. And you know, you put a guy like Flavian Pratt into a scenario like that, he's going to be very tough. And he did exactly the right thing on Silver Knot by racing him forwardly, putting him in position to grab the baton when the front runners faltered, which is exactly what happened around the half mile pole. And that just gave him a massive tactical advantage over Bold Act. And it was enough for him to score a slight upset.
Let's move on to the last race of this podcast. We're going to go to race number 10. It's another allowance. This one, an N1X, 5.5 on the turf. Let's kind of get our turf sprint thinking caps on here. Nick, what'd you like in this one?
Yeah, so this was a tough race. I mean, it was difficult because if you believed like I did that being forwardly placed provided an advantage, then, you know, you probably wanted to be somewhat careful in terms of how much stock you put on Proud Mary, who looked like a pretty deserving, solid favorite, a filly who had run well enough at Keeneland before, was coming back off a layoff for Jonathan Thomas, but he's got a very good record with fresh horses. And she had also trained, it looked like she was training very well. He has he's almost a savant with turf sprinters as well, hitting at like a 40% clip the last 3 years. And so I thought she would be very dangerous. I made a bit too high on the morning line, the 11, All I Want Is You, who was coming into this off a poor effort on the synthetic. And she had actually been pretty soundly outfinished by Proud Mary in the allowance race from late October of 2023 at Keeneland, but the public really honed in on her pretty early and felt like she had a good shot. She was bet in half from the 10 down to 5. I thought she was a contender, and that was basically it for me. I mean, the other horse that took a pretty substantial amount of money was the 5 Definite Diva, but I didn't really like her. I thought she had beaten kind of a suspect field at Gulfstream going 5/8, and I don't really love taking the 5/8 form and putting a lot into it going 5.5 at a place like Keeneland. I think a lot of those 5/8 races, you know, they end up just being sort of sprints to the turn, and if you get there first, you've got a big edge. So it was mainly 2/11 for me.
I think as well, and this, with 5.5, 7, the weird type of races that you see, keep a track profile with the distances you struggle on. You can really all of a sudden figure out, wow, you know, the horses that are winning these 5.5, so, you know, aren't coming from 4 or 5 back. Oh, there's 6 out of the 8 horses that are 4 or 5 back 9 times out of 10. Oh, look, I found an exacta that hits. I'm not going to say it's going to hit every time, but when you can cut down on your pretenders and just focus on the contenders for the race, it really helps you just, A, handicap more races, and B, just obviously have more fun because you could possibly cash in more tickets. I thought Empire Princess was one that was interesting in here. This one, I know you had said how being forwardly placed was so important. For me, I just kind of like horses that, you know, obviously got the right kind of trip last time out. Now is, had that 75. If Proud Mary runs that 81, sure is going to get the job done, but I kind of thought at 16-1, another across the board bet kind of makes sense here. I also backed it up with Proud Mary and this one in an exacta, but I just thought Empire Princess was not going off at too high a price, but these are the type of horses that I kind of like to play across the board, because if they run second, I'm still going to make some money out.
Yeah, I agree. We were getting a big price, no doubt about it. I think she was what, 16-1 or mm-hmm. So I think that was a fair number. Yeah, I think it was a race where you wanted to shop for a little bit of value. And I mean, it did feel on paper like there was a pretty significant amount of speed. So even though you wanted to be forwardly placed on the turf course, this did feel like it could be the proverbial bias breaker, in that they maybe were just going to go a little too quick.
Empire Princess for myself. We're looking at Proud Mary and All I Want Is You for Nick. Let's see who gets it done in the 10th right now.
Off. There goes Bobby Sox out for the early lead. Cabernet is there. Parola Secure up on the outside. Integrated Design is there. Indefinite Diva up close. Moving up one lane off the rail from the fifth position. Fast Lonnie is away in sixth. Empire's Princess, seventh. Agent is eighth on her outside. Proud Mary, ninth. Back toward the rail. Sweet Duchess in tenth as they head to the far turn. All I Want Is You is in the 11th position. Has a lot of ground to make up and a lot of traffic to deal with from there. Golden Dagger, last of the 12. Bobby Sox, the leader, 20.95 seconds to time for the opening quarter. Integrated Design, two lengths away in second. Parola Sakura is third up on the outside. Cabernet is in fourth. Definite Diva is fifth. Swings wide for the drive, still five lengths off the lead. Bobby Sox, Integrated Design alongside. Parola Sakura is right there. And then Definite Diva on the outside is still wide open. Agents enter the course. Here's All I Want Is You. All I Want Is You is bursting through an opening down to the inside. All I Want What Is You, Flavian Pratt, with a masterful stretch run here to win it. Proud Mary.
And it is All I Want Is You getting the job done. Gets bet down, gets the money. 77 the winning buyer, 1388 the winning mutual. I run fourth today with two across the board bets, and it is what it is. Proud Mary ends up running that 72. Did not get back up to that 81 from three back, and it's hard to say, right, when you see horses run like that. At 1.36 to 1, probably not a favorite you want to back more often than not.
Yeah, she was a little overbet, no doubt about it. It was tough to take her at that price, knowing that she was not only going to have to be ready off the layoff, but she was going to have to negotiate a trip coming from off of it. So she dipped down way too much odds-wise, and that did create a little bit of value elsewhere. Again, I was a little surprised at the amount of money that Definite Diva took. I just didn't see much of an opportunity for her to win this race with the way it looked like it was going to unfold on paper. And I mentioned All I Want Is You ahead of time because of the races she had run last year, specifically second off the layoff at Colonial. And when she started taking the money that she did, I think it was pretty clear at that point that she was going to be a major threat. And boy, Spencer, did she get a great ride. I mean, it was, you know, Flavian Pratt just cool as a cucumber, waiting to figure out where he wanted to make his move. And once a little bit of an opening made itself available in upper stretch, he had no problem putting her through there, and she was very willing to do so as well, whereas the favorite, who had no excuse, was in position and just came up wanting late. Maybe she needed a race, and she'll be wound a little bit tighter next time out, but it was an excellent ride and a great trip for a horse that obviously was quite ready off the layoff. And, you know, I've got to say, I think the public is certainly hip to it now too, but Nacho Correas is a trainer who I think is very underrated in terms of his ability on both surfaces. He's obviously a Breeders' Cup Distaff winner, and he's trained quite a few graded stakes caliber horses over the years that I've been very impressed with. He finished second or third in last year's Breeders' Cup Distaff again. So he's a guy you want to keep an eye on for sure.
Last thing before we let you go, just the Definite Diva thing. I tend to agree with you. I feel that for me, just knowing how I was brought up handicapping, it's not so much you kind of like look through the horse, but you find certain trainers and not spots, but just ideas. So for me, Kelly Breen's one who I always double circle on turf sprints just from Monmouth and et cetera, places like that. And I think a lot of other people do as well. They see a guy win, you know, however many races they do as their handicapping, and they just like, no matter what the odds, I'm going to circle him. And he's almost always a semi-contender in a way. And I feel like maybe that's what people thought maybe with Definitive Diva.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the IRAD factor, right? Yep. I mean, IRAD's horses are going to take more money than anybody else's from a jockey perspective. So no surprise that anybody would want to back this filly given that part of it. And no great shock, in my opinion, that she took the money that she did. It's funny, I used to read Steve Crist in his daily Saratoga column years ago. When turf sprints were becoming popular at Saratoga, he would sort of lament their popularity because he felt like they were really hard to handicap and they were just tricky. You often had converging form and distances, and, you know, horses were cutting back and some were stretching out and some were going from 5 to 5.5. You know, it's a slight stretch out. So I think you can easily overcomplicate the whole thing. But I think one of the fundamental differences is that the majority of these 5/8 turf sprints are races that really, they more often than not go to whoever's fastest early. And I just don't think that 5.5 at a place like Keeneland plays the same way. And I know, of course, looking at this race in particular, it's easy to say that because the winner came from deep in the pack. But I think in general, you want to take a little bit more of an open-minded approach to races at 5.5. You know, now it'll be a few years, but we'll eventually get 6 furlongs at Belmont again. We're going to get a lot of 6 furlongs at Aqueduct moving forward now that that they've moved racing to the turf. We won't get 7/8 at Belmont for a few years, but those are very different races as well. So I think you want to treat them as individual events, but you definitely don't want to carry forward any handicapping principles that you applied at a different distance, especially a shorter one, especially at a place like Gulfstream where, you know, the majority of that race is run on the turn. Right. I mean, the stretch is not very long at Gulfstream. They basically run about 1.5 furlongs in the stretch, and they run about, you know, roughly almost two on the turn, and 1.5 furlongs or so down the backstretch. So it's important to keep that in mind and not just really assume that, oh, well, this horse is fast, she's going to get the lead.
I agree with everything you said there, Nick. Thank you so much for coming on. Obviously, and the money's going strong here with the Derby stuff, and hopefully we can have you back on for the Derby card. Anything else going on with you for the next few weeks leading up to Derby?
No, it'll be a lot of fun. I think there's going to be an announcement coming out about a show that I'm going to do next week, one with PTF and Jonathan and one with a couple of special guests in the lead up to Derby. So very, very excited about that. Should be a fun time. And obviously this is horse player holiday season. So I'm looking forward to everything and seeing how it all shakes out next week. I find myself every year at Derby time trying to envision what a stretch drive of each of the horses that I think are contenders looks like. And so I guess I'm underway in looking at that. Fortunately, I've also finished all the Keeneland morning lines, so there's no work left to do on that front, which is definitely nice.
Thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, my friend. Anytime.
Who listens to this podcast and the rest of the podcast on the In the Money Media Network. Also want to thank my special guest, Nick Tamaro, for coming on, talking all things Keeneland with myself. This show has been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's president is Peter Thomas Fornatale. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. And the In the Money Media business manager is Drew Coatney. I'm Spencer Lugenbuehl. We will see you next time.